We venture upriver to the Canieri claims. Thomas Balfour's inquiry at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand that morning had piqued the banker's curiosity on several fronts, and as soon as the former had left the building, Mr. Frost immediately resolved to do some inquiring of his own. He was still holding in his hand the shares profile of the Aurora gold mine, owned and operated by the vanished prospector Emery Staines. Aurora, Frost thought, tapping the document with his lean finger. Aurora! He knew that he had seen that name recently. But where? After a moment he laid the document aside, clambered down from his stool, and padded to the cabinet opposite his cubicle, where a row of leather spines were marked with the words, "Returns by Quarter." He selected the third and fourth quarters of the previous year, and returned to his desk to examine the gold mine's records. Charlie Frost was a man of scant reputation, for such a thing is only ever claimed, and Frost was a quiet soul, modest in his dress, mild in his features, and disinclined, whatever the provocation, to disturb the peace. When he spoke, it was slowly and with care. He rarely laughed openly, and although his posture was languid and easy, he always seemed alert, as if perpetually mindful of some rule of etiquette that other men no longer observed. He did not like to declare his preferences or to hold forth in speech. In fact, he was reluctant, when in conversation, to assert an agenda of any kind. This was not at all to say that Frost lacked agenda, or that his preferences were few. In fact, the many rituals of his private life were regulated in the extreme, and his ambitions were tremendously particular. Rather, Frost had learned the value of appearing to be unassuming. He knew the latent power of obscurity, powerful because it aroused curiosity in others, and he was capable of great strategy in wielding it. But he took extreme care to keep this talent hidden. The impression that strangers invariably formed upon first meeting him was that he was a man of reaction rather than of action, who was managed in business, seduced in love, and steadfastly docile in all his pleasures. Frost was but 24 years of age, and New Zealand-born. His father had been a high-level official in the now-defunct New Zealand Company, who, upon disembarking at the mouth of the Hutt River and finding a wealth of flat land to be divided and sold, had promptly sent home for a wife. Frost was not proud of the fact of his birth, for it was a rare citizenship for a white man to hold, and he felt that it was shaming. He told no stories about his childhood, spent in the marshy flat of the Hutt Valley, reading and rereading his father's thumbed copy of Paradise Lost, the only book besides the Bible that the family possessed. By the age of 8, Frost could recite every speech of God's, the sun's, and Adam's, but never Satan's, whom he found pugnacious, and never Eve's, whom he thought feeble and a bore. It was not an unhappy childhood, but Frost was unhappy when he recalled it. When he spoke about England, it was as though he missed that place very dearly and could not wait to return. With the dissolution of the New Zealand Company, Mr. Frost Senior was all but bankrupted and cast into disrepute. He turned to his only son for aid. Charlie Frost secured scribal work in Wellington, and soon was offered a place at a bank in the Lambton Quarter, a position that earned him enough to keep his parents in health and relative comfort. When gold was discovered in Otago, Frost transferred to a bank at Lawrence, promising to send the larger portion of his wages home each month by private mail, a promise he had never broken. He had not once returned home to the Hutt Valley, however, and did not plan to. Charlie Frost tended to conceive of all his relationships in terms of profit and return, and he did not spare a thought for others once he considered that his duty had been served. Now, in Hokitika, for he had followed the rush from Lawrence to the coast, he did not think at all about his parents, except when he was writing to them each month. This was a difficult task, for his father's letters were abrupt and mortified, and his mother's full of a dismayed silence, sentiments that grieved Charlie Frost, but only briefly. After his replies had been written and dispatched, he shredded their letters into spills for lighting his cigars, cutting the pages lengthwise so as to occlude their import absolutely. The spills he burned with great indifference. Frost thumbed through the returns folder until he found the section that pertained to Canieri and the Hokitika Gorge. The records were listed alphabetically, with the Aurora as the second, beneath a claim that had been named, rather optimistically for the West Coast, the All Seasons. Frost leant in close to the page to read the figures, and in the next moment he gave a murmur of surprise. In the month following its initial purchase, the Aurora claim had performed splendidly, pulling in almost £100. Come August, however, the claim's profits had dropped off radically until, Frost raised his eyebrows, virtually coming to a halt. The sum total of the Aurora's profits over the last quarter was only £12. £1 weekly. That was very odd for a mine of Aurora's depth and promise. £1 weekly? Why, that would be barely enough to cover the overheads, Frost thought. He bent closer over the book. The record showed that the Aurora was worked by one man only. The name was a Chinese one, so the labour would be cheap. But even so, Frost thought, the digger would still have to be paid a daily wage. Charlie Frost was frowning. According to the share's profile, Emery Staines had first taken over the Aurora gold mine in the late autumn of the previous year. It appeared that some weeks after this purchase, Staines had sold 50% shares to the notorious Francis Carver. However, immediately following that transaction, as this record showed, the claim had run suddenly dry. Either Aurora had become all of a sudden a duffer claim, worth virtually nothing, or someone was doing a very good job of making it seem that way. Frost shut the folder and stood for a moment thinking. His gaze wandered over the crowd, the diggers in their slouch hats, the investors, the escort in their braided epaulettes. Suddenly he remembered where he had seen that name before. He put up a card in his cubicle to indicate that the window was closed.
"You off for the day?" a colleague asked.
"I suppose I could be," said Frost, blinking. "I hadn't thought that I might. I had intended to return after my lunch hour."
"We'll be closed by 2, and there's no more buying today once this lot is done,"
the other banker said. He stretched his back and slapped his belly with both hands.
"May as well see you Monday, Charlie."
"Well,"
Frost murmured, gazing into the crown of his hat as though suddenly perplexed to see it in his hand.
"That's very kind of you. Thank you very much."
Dick Mannering was alone in his office when Frost knocked upon the door. At his knock, Mannering's collie dog burst from beneath the desk in an explosion of joyful energy. She leapt upon Frost, her tail thumping the floor, her red mouth open.